Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
So I'm here at Portland Retro Gaming Expo with Frank Cifaldi, Retronauts alumnus.
Hello.
And it's the eve of the NES's 30th anniversary in America.
It is.
And I can think of no other person more appropriate to talk to besides like Masayuki Uemura or someone, you know, Gil Tilden maybe, I don't know.
Sure, Gail Howard.
Arakawa. But lacking access to them, we'll go with Frank.
I've talked to some of those people.
I have. Well, Uemura, that's it.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I guess between the two of us, we've spent a lot of time thinking about this momentous occasion in history.
We have, and frankly, I don't exactly know why. You know, like I know that system's important to us, but why are we so compelled by the way it was initially sold?
That's actually a good question. I guess because it is this sort of very unique time in sort of the development of video games. You know, it represents a couple of landmarks. For one thing, you know, obviously there had been the whole market crash with console games in the U.S. And see, even they're happy about the NES's launch.
No, they just like the market crash.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm happy about that, too.
The games are really cheap after the crash.
So. That was my memory, yes. Like, oh, I can get all these ColecoVision games for $5. But no, you know, it helped resuscitate a market that could have kind of foundered and vanished. I mean, you know,
that's why it's so fascinating, right? It's such a good story.
You saw in the U.K., like, there was no console market until the 16-bit era because they had cheap, inexpensive, easy access PCs that they could play on, and so that became the market over there. That could have been the case here, but the NES helped kind of push us away from that and really strengthen the console market here. It's also significant in that it was the first Japanese console to have a significant, foreign console really, to have a significant presence in the US, and that really, I think, shaped the direction that games took for years after, and kind of the nature of the global games industry as a whole.
Right, but I think more than that, it's just kind of a good story. You know, like it's something that we've known since Game Over was published in 1993. You know, about the crazy Nintendo Strike Force that airlanded, you know, on New York and forced game systems into FAO Schwartz against their will and brought back the video game industry through sheer determination, right? I mean, it's a narrative that I think we all enjoy and kind of want to know more about.
Yeah, I think maybe you over-dramatized it just a bit.
They forced it in there. They pushed it.
You're going to take these games whether you like them or not. But no, it is interesting. And
Actually, interesting side note about getting it in FAO Schwartz. I don't think a lot of people know this. I don't know who the sales rep was for Nintendo, but when they brought it to FAO Schwartz, which, by the way, we might be getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but FAO Schwartz was kind of the premier place where it debuted. It was the big toy store in New York. When Nintendo sales rep brought a sample to FAO Schwartz, they gave it to this younger kid who was working there to kind of bring it home and evaluate. So he did, and he came back and he's like, "Guys, we got to sell that." That guy is Joe Quesada.
Oh yeah,
who is like the chief creative something at Marvel Comics?
He was ESE for a while. I don't know what he is now.
Yeah,
yeah. That's crazy. I had no idea there was that connection.
That's a weird connection to have.
You'd think that there would have been better X-Men and Silver Surfer games on NES.
I did ask him if he still had that Nintendo, and he's like, no, I lost it to an X.
Oh.
Imagine that.
Breakups.
What was the serial number of that one?
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Masayuki Uemura, the designer of the NES hardware, the Famicom hardware. I went to his 30th anniversary presentation at New York University's Game Center a few days ago, and I had the opportunity to talk to him and interview him, and I asked him what was the hardest part of bringing the NES to America, bringing the Famicom to America, and he said it was getting it past the market's resistance. That's not just, you know, something we've turned into this interesting story. Like, legitimately, it was a huge challenge for them, and they spent a lot of time researching the market and evaluating things, and really kind of, he said they basically brought the system over here despite pretty much everyone telling them, no, it's not a good idea.
Right.
Like, all the marketing representatives and retail buyers were saying, this market is dead, this is stupid, no one's going to buy video games, right. This would be pointless, it's over, it's gone.
I mean, you're talking to buyers for stores who, you know, in some cases at least, like, probably lost their previous jobs over investing too much in buying video game product that they had to blow out at a loss. You know, it was a big hit for retailers, and the brilliance of Nintendo was recognizing that the players didn't go away. You know, it was just an oversaturated market.
Right. Like, they still wanted more.
Yeah, Uemura said that part of what drove them to go ahead and make the push anyway was the fact that, you know, they had the Versus system in arcades, and games like, you know, Hogan's Alley and baseball and tennis were really successful. Like, those arcade machines were far more successful in America than in Japan. Like, the idea of the Versus concept, you know, going head-to-head against people, like, really caught on with Americans, whereas he said, you know, Japan, competition's not such a big thing, so these systems didn't really do anything. But in America, they were successful, and that made them say, well, obviously, these games are enjoyable, we just have to figure out how to get them to people beyond the arcades.
Yeah, I actually had never considered the success of the Versus systems as contributing to the launch of the NES. I think it's really cool. I think it's also, you know, if we're going into, like, trying to repaint that picture, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's also kind of important to remember how popular toy robots were in 1985 in America.
Yeah, I mean, the robot operating buddy, Rob, was basically a giant ripoff of the Omnibot 2000.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, yeah.
Which I just saw at Steve Lin's booth here at the Portland Retro Game Expo.
You
and
didn't buy it.
I didn't. It's $200. It's not nearly as expensive as I would have thought. But yeah, like, when you see it, my first thought was, whoa, that's a huge Rob mock-up. And then I remembered, no, wait, no, that's the thing that Rob was ripping off. Like, the little robot that rode out on silver spoons and, you know, like, it was just kind of this little cute robot. Johnny Five was kind of the same, cut from the same cloth. So,
right. So
using that, again, Uemura said, like, no one cared about the robot, about Rob in Japan. But in America, it became kind of this icon, even though... He admitted no one knew how to use it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, even in Japan, I think it was just another one of the toys that came out of R&D. You know, they were a toy company for a long time, and I think that DNA was still there. You know,
I think Nintendo's toy maker DNA has never gone away.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's had a resurgence with, you know, Amiibo, but you look at things like, especially with the R&D 1 type games like WarioWare, that sort of thing, like, there's always some kind of interesting gimmick. You know, Game Boy Camera, that sort of thing. There's always been this, like, fascination with gadgets running through Nintendo, and I think that really worked to their advantage with the NES launch.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, there's experiments that didn't work, but they keep doing them. Like the sewing machine accessory for the NES that appeared at a trade show in 1987 and was never heard from again, or the heart monitor for the Wii, whatever that was called.
Oh yeah, the vitality sensor.
Yeah. When's that coming? Like you know, that's part of what Nintendo does, is they just, like, make fun toys and see what sticks. And I think, you know, their ability to do that, you know, contributed immensely to the success of the NES. Although, you know, it's, I don't know how much I believe that narrative. I don't know how much I believe the narrative that people bought the NES because there was a robot. I can believe that retailers bought the NES because there was a robot.
I think that was the idea, was to sneak it in as a Trojan horse to say, oh, no, this is a toy set. It's an entertainment system. That's what Umari said was, you know, it wasn't a video game system because we had the robot.
Yeah.
It was an entertainment system. It was something bigger. It went beyond that. Yeah. Also, the Zapper guns, he said, you know, very popular in America, not so much in Japan. So Duck Hunt was a huge success over here versus overseas. So, yeah, like, there is this kind of visual iconography that's become a part of the NES. But something that I thought was interesting listening to him talk was that he kind of put things in a different context than I realized. You know, they started researching, doing market research into bringing the Famicom to America early, like at the beginning of 1984, which was about half a year after the Famicom launched. And throughout 1983 and 84, the Famicom was a big flop in Japan. It wasn't a success.
Sure.
They started looking to America, not because they were like, let's take the success and go international with it, but more like, we are bombing here, and we have got to get some success somewhere else, or this whole thing is going to be for nothing.
Well, I mean, you probably know this, but they took it to Atari. Mm. So they took, from what I understand, they took to Atari a Famicom and some demos of Atari games that they ported to the Famicom.
It wasn't just them. It was HAL. Satoru Iwata ported them.
Right.
And those games did eventually come out for NES. They were going to be first-party published games.
Yeah.
There was an interesting interview with someone from HAL that just recently showed up on Gamasutra.
Yeah.
And, like, that whole story is really interesting.
Well, I don't know that they all came out.
Three of the four did.
What was the fourth one?
I don't remember. There was Millipede, Joust, and Stargate, Defender 2.
Because I know from talking to someone who was at Atari at the time that they brought a port of Kangaroo, which I don't think is documented anywhere. So you just got a scoop right there.
All right. That's the missing piece. But, yeah, anyway, so they took these games to Atari.
The point is that you're right. Like, it was a failure in Japan, and they were looking at America early on. I kind of suspect that they weren't maybe as cognizant of the... Well, there was... The crash wasn't like a moment that happened, right?
I mean, the point that everyone points to is... The moment that everyone points to is Warner's financials at the end of 1982, because all of a sudden this billion-dollar industry was like a billion-dollar loss.
Right, yeah. But what people don't tend to point out is that... again, people kept buying games. 1984 was a record year for cartridge game sales, except that they were bought for below cost.
Right, instead of selling for $20, they were selling for $2.
Right, so, like, it's, again, like, the appetites were there, and it was, you know, I think Arakawa's brilliance is, I mean, when you talk to people at Nintendo, they all just, you know, Mr. Arakawa is the one who made this happen. Like, he's the one who believed in it, and that's just... From what I know, and God, I hope I get to talk to the guy someday. You know, his belief that in things working is what got a lot of things off the ground. It's what brought RPGs to America eventually. You know, it's what made Nintendo power happen here. It's just his belief that the kids in Japan aren't all that different to the kids in America. So it's just a matter of marketing.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what they recognize, and that's why the NES ultimately happened, is because he just knew it would work if it was done right. Let's just do it right.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something about having a really scary father-in-law that compels a man to do his best, and that certainly was the case for Arakawa.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, judging by Game Over anyway.
Well, no, everything I've heard about Hiroshi Yamauchi not a kind and gentle old man.
No, he was very stern and strict. And it's funny, if you read old, you know, old interviews with him, like, journalists will try to ask, like, what do you think of Miyamoto? You know, he's pretty good for your company, right? Is he important to you? And, you know, his reply would always just be, he's an employee. I pay him. You know, like, that's just the kind of guy he was.
Thank you.
So, looking back at the NES launch, what do you think was the most important thing about the system when it made its debut? You know, it had that kind of slow rollout, New York, then San Francisco, then, you know, by the middle of 1986, basically nationwide. Yeah. Like, if you could point to one thing that, and say, like, this is it, like, this is what defined the NES, this is what made it a big deal.
I'm not going to say this is what defined it, but this is what made people buy it, I think, is, and I don't hear anyone say this ever, the graphics were much better than the systems that existed.
Yeah, they really were. I mean, for me, that was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Like, you look back at those old black box games, like the sports games, baseball, tennis, like, they're very simplistic, yes, but they have a lot of detail and a lot, like, tennis, I was replaying it recently, and there is a lot of care put into a very simple game. The animation on your players, like, they don't have mirrored graphics, they have a dominant arm,
right.
And depending on how you run around, they reflect that in their motion. The scaling on the ball was very simple, but it was very easy to tell where the ball was relative to your players. You know, baseball, little things like before you can pitch the ball, the pitcher kind of, like, turns his head and adjusts his posture. Like, stuff like that really added a lot of personality. And I think, you know, the not just the level of detail in the graphics, but also the level of personality.
And I was about to say that, like, you know, this is kind of hard to think about now, but, like, you could see the eyeball on the duck in Duck Hunt, you know, and it changed expression when it got shot.
Yeah.
You know, that was new for home games anyway.
I mean, I this is one of those cases where, you know, you always want to be careful about giving Shigeru Miyamoto too much credit and being like, he is everything to Nintendo. But, like, the art in those games was very clearly, especially Duck Hunt, Hogan's Alley, Wild Gunman, like, those were characters drawn by Miyamoto. Like, he had a distinct style.
Yeah.
And,
well, and yeah, I don't know that how much he actually contributed to those games versus how much his style contributed to the house style at Nintendo, right? But yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, having a cartoonist in the office.
Exactly.
You know, like, actually putting character into the games. Yeah, that was new to games, almost. You know, like, you see a little bit of that in the arcades. You look at games like Tapper, or I think Tapper is old enough to count here, right? Before all that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're like the sort of midway games of that era. You know, you see some of that, but not really in the home. And I don't know how much of that is just because people didn't bother, or because they just could not easily, you know, show character in their graphics. But I, you know, going back to your question, I think that's what sold the system. They it's not like they just put them in stores. Like, their test market launch was people from Nintendo in front of the Nintendo showing it to people, putting it in their hands and having them play it. And I think people bought into it because it was a next-gen system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, you know, I think the Trojan horse thing ultimately was unnecessary for the buyer, who I think only cared about, you know, the fact that this was a new video game system that played hot new games. And I think they learned that very quickly, because their whatever they called it, the deluxe set, no, not the deluxe set, the one with just Mario.
The action set?
Yeah, the action set, you know, came out, I think, when they launched nationally. They launched with that set. So I think during the test market launch, they might have learned that this other junk was unnecessary, and they just stripped it down.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of talked about, like, what you think was the biggest point of the biggest point of appeal in the NES. What is your first memory of the NES?
Oh, what is my first memory of the NES? I know it was Super Mario Brothers. I think my first memory of the NES was watching a couple of my cousins play the NES and play Super Mario Brothers on the NES. They were playing two-player. And I don't don't specifically recall having an aha moment. I just recall having a ha-ha moment, which was when Mario was jumping and my cousin, who was on player two, paused mid-jump just to mess with his trajectory so that when he unpaused, he would fall. I think that's the earliest NES memory I have. I don't specifically remember being wowed by it, to be honest. Like, I was born with an Atari, and I don't know, like, the NES came out, and I think I was too young to go, those graphics are better. I think I was still young enough to where I didn't care I was just like, more video games, you know? So I never had that wow moment with the NES, but, you know, it was always around, and I loved it.
Yeah, I think being just a few years younger or older than you, yeah. My memories are a little more fully formed, and the NES did make a really big first impression on me. I remember, did you ever have Federated electronic stores when you were
no,
a kid?
No. Okay.
It was basically like before there was Best Buy, before there was Circuit City, there was Federated, and it was kind of the same thing, like,
yeah.
You know, televisions and record players.
We had a team called Silo
where I grew up. I don't know if that was big or not.
Never heard of that one. But I remember walking through the Federated that was very briefly, like, for 1 year in my city, and, like, later it turned into a church, which is kind of a weird, like, turning retail space into a church. Why not? Sell God. but, yeah, I remember walking through there, and they had sort of this computer area set up, and I remember seeing an Amiga and being like, wow.
Yeah.
So, like, it had just some kind of graphical demo, and I was amazed. And then I walked over a couple of aisles, and there was an NES set up with Kung Fu. And that impressed me even more because I guess, you know, the Amiga just seemed like one of these incredibly expensive things that we would never be able to own. But the NES, like, that was something that spoke to me directly. It was like, yeah. This is a video game system. You know people with video game systems. You could own a video game system. Look how good this is. I had, you know, seen Pac-Man on Atari. We didn't have an Atari, but we, you know, I had lots of friends who did.
Sure.
So I'd seen stuff like Pac-Man, which was bad, Pitfall, which was good, Yar's Revenge, which was interesting and complicated. But none of those compared to Kung Fu, which had, like, this very capably animated guy
yeah.
walking, punching midgets for some reason,
yeah.
punching guys with knives. There were, like, little Chinese lanterns that would fall and dragons would pop out of them. And it was so colorful and vivid. I just said, I need to own this system.
Like, and a lot of that was that's the first time that you, like, recognized what those things were supposed to be instead of having to fill in the blanks, right?
Right. They didn't have that level of abstraction that yeah. Intellivision and even ColecoVision. Like, I had a ColecoVision we got once the market crashed, and it was very cheap, and games for it were very cheap. I even had some Nintendo games on it. You know, Coleco had Donkey Kong Jr. And, you know, it did have some pretty good-looking games, but there was still this kind of, like, there was just something about the ColecoVision that was lacking compared to the NES. It didn't seem as vivid.
Yeah.
It didn't seem as fast-paced. I mean, Kung Fu scrolled smoothly, which the ColecoVision did not do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you had Zaxxon, and that was probably the most impressive thing on the system. But the NES just, like, immediately, it caught my attention, and
yeah.
I knew I had to have one. It took me a couple of years to get one, but I did eventually grab one.
I think scrolling is actually, now that you mention it, kind of an underrated innovation of the technology in the NES. Because
mm-hmm.
You didn't really see that. I mean, you saw it a little bit. No, not really. Like,
no,
I was about to say
consoles.
I was about to say you saw it in Pitfall. I'm like, no, you didn't.
No,
it was one screen at a time. No, like, the smooth scrolling you got on the NES was really only on the NES. And, I mean, granted, you didn't see too much good use of it until you saw Super Mario Brothers, but that was a launch game here, probably.
Yeah, I mean, like, Kung Fu scrolled horizontally, Excitebike
sure.
scrolled horizontally, Ice Climber scrolled vertically.
Yeah.
So there was, you know, there was a fair amount.
No, but the Ice Climber scroll wasn't fluid.
No,
it was
but
jumpy.
But still,
yeah.
It's still, it wasn't flip screen.
Yeah,
it wasn't
sure.
going from screen to screen. Even Urban Champion, which was garbage,
yeah.
had, you know, scrolling. So
right,
that was
just made it, like, not only do you have convincing characters, they're now inhabiting a convincing space.
Right. Yeah.
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 So yeah, the NES, there was kind of the marketing appeal, but then there was also just the conceptual level of the system and the design of the software. And
yeah.
I think neither of those things could exist separately. Like, they had to work in tandem for the NES to be a success.
To be a success here, you mean, with the like,
right.
mixing the game quality with the marketing we had here.
Sure.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And the marketing here isn't really talked about too often, but, you know, it's, like, if you look at those black box games, the purpose of putting those graphics on the box, like, painting those pixels, and it is paint if you look close.
Yeah, Link doesn't really smile in Kid Icarus.
No. The purpose of doing that was because one of the, you know, when they got serious and they're like, you're going to launch this system in the U.S., they really kind of, you know, sat down and came up with their list of why the industry crashed, and one of the factors that they identified was that the games, the way the games were selling themselves on systems like Atari was not based on the reality of what you got when you played it. So, you know, for example, you pick up a box that's beautifully painted illustration of a guy, you know, swinging a tennis racket, but
all that great airbrushing.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
that was something I love about the Atari, but it was very like Pong had nothing to do with what was actually inside the game.
Right. Or like Missile Command was that guy at the weird console. So the point is like they sold the games based arguably on a lie, right? Like this is the experience this game's going to give you. And what Nintendo wanted to do was do the complete opposite of that. So the biggest thing you see when you see a Nintendo game is what the game actually looks like.
Sort of. Those paintings were all a little more detailed than the actual graphics.
Not always.
Look at the baseball.
Almost always. Those were the original bull shots.
Sometimes, but I'm not convinced if you actually look at them. Like there's some, like you said, Pitt and Kid Icarus. Yeah, they drew a little smile.
There's a little more resolution, a little more detail on the boxes, but it's fine. Like it got the point across. I don't agree.
Let's go in the
we right now. We could not look at emulator crispness at the time. So what we saw on the TV screens was pretty much what we saw in the boxes.
No, absolutely. And on the TV screen, it actually looked a little better in the boxes because they're smaller. But yeah, that was the idea. It's like let's actually sell them on the games instead of convincing them to buy us the money and hoping that they like it later. You know, it's just, if you look at those old boxes, even the screenshots and everything, they're just very representative of what you get. And, you know, that was brilliant on their part. It's a hard thing to appreciate now, but that was new at the time. You know, was actually showing what the games look like.
So just to wrap it up, you know, we've talked kind of about the launch and everything, but what is it about the NES and sort of like the system beyond launch that you think has managed to become so enduring? I mean, it's shockingly popular 30 years later. Like the prices on old NES games have skyrocketed in recent years. It's kind of crazy.
It's weird. It's like at the time, I think everyone remembers that the word Nintendo meant video game. You know, any video game was Nintendo. Like even if it wasn't, right? And in a weird way, that's almost persisted because I think when people think video game, they tend to think of Super Mario Brothers, right? They tend to think of a D-pad, and they think of pixel graphics, like and like cartridges, right? I think that's still the stereotypical video game, and I think a lot of that has to do with Nintendo's, you know, complete dominance of the market that didn't exist otherwise, you know, and in a weird way, I think they defined modern video games by being, you know, the only player in town. And yes, I know the Atari and the Sega Master System came out at the same time. Like, no one cares. But I think that by defining what video games were, they kind of, you know, put that stake in the ground, and I think that in a lot of ways, people just think of Nintendo as where games as we know them started. So I think the NES is still seen as the foundation of the way we play video games now. And I would not argue that fact. I think a lot of the genres we still play, you know, ultimately, well, not all of them, but a lot of them had their sort of prototypical birth in that era and on that system. And I think a lot of the ways we play games now, you know, should be attributed to the success of the NES. And I think that's why it still stands up.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention how Nintendo became synonymous with video games. Because before that, you played Atari. Yeah. Like, Atari was the word for video games. But, you know, when they kind of languished and Nintendo took that, and there's never been a gap in continuity in Nintendo public, you know,
right,
consoles and games. Like, they never went away.
Right. Like
maybe that's the why they've managed to be so dominant.
No, absolutely. And I do think, you know, I do think, since we're talking about collector prices, I do think that's the main contributing factor to that, is that Nintendo never went away. Nintendo's still marketing the franchises that are on the NES. So, you know, that's a big factor in why it's continued to be collected and sought after for whatever that's worth.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm here on the 30th anniversary of the NES with Gary Butterfield of Watch Out for Fireballs. Gary?
Hey, Jeremy. How's it going?
Not bad. Thanks for coming out to our little shindig, our Retronauts shindig. So yeah, like I said, today is the 30th anniversary of the NES's launch in America. Not we, but other people have pinpointed it to October 18th, 1985 was the U.S. launch, the test launch in New York City of the NES. Are you actually 30 years old? Or are you old enough to potentially even remember this happening?
I'm 35, so I'm a little bit older than that even.
Okay, you're an old person like me.
I am, absolutely. I commiserate on the podcast listening whenever you talk about being an old person.
All right, yeah. Good man.
Yeah. Yeah, so I remember growing up, we had an Atari for a long time in my family, and we lived in a trailer park, actually, and the kids who watched us got a Nintendo before we did, and that's how I got to play Mario Brothers for the first time, probably 1986, so afterwards, and I didn't actually get my own NES for a couple years after that, but... It was really amazing, and I'm sure I was an intolerable kid because I wanted something really badly, and a kid who wants something is usually...
Yeah, pretty difficult to get along with.
Yeah.
Yeah, my brother and I actually saved up money from a few Christmases and birthdays and whatever to buy an NES. We went in together on it. Then my brother ended up not liking video games that much, so it pretty much became my NES, even though he paid for half of it. But... Yeah, I got into it right at the peak of the popularity of the system when it really started to take off, and I want to say it was the end of 1987. I'd played it before that at friends' houses, and finally I had enough money to buy it. But the problem was I couldn't buy one because it was sold out all across the country. And my father ended up taking a road trip for some reason, I can't remember exactly why, to Michigan. And I lived in Texas at the time. And he came back from Michigan with the NES that we wanted. So that was... pretty rad, but like it was nowhere to be found where I lived.
Yeah, I don't know about any kind of shortage. At the time, my parents were buying things, so I just wanted it and was insufferable. And then one day on Christmas, came home and came home. I was out that day for work for Christmas as a kid.
You were delivering gifts and
yeah, I came home from bed. It was a weird house setup, and ended up having it, and it was an amazing Christmas because I had this stratum of games. I had Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, which is really good, and then I had Mega Man 2. So it was shortly after Mega Man 2 was very new at the time I got my NES.
So that would be 1989.
Yeah, 1989 is when I finally got my own. I'd seen it before, and then the third game was Operation Wolf. So there was this stratum of quality, even then I remember just one half of this is a good NES game, and this is one I'm not as interested in shooting these strangers in the jungle.
Yeah, Operation Wolf is a weird NES game because it's actually a lot more fun if you don't use the zapper, even though it is a light gun game. If you just use the controller, it's so much easier and more enjoyable.
Yeah, I did not know that at the time. I used the zapper exclusively because I had the entire... I didn't have the set that came with the Rob, but, it came with the zapper. And
I don't think they were selling Rob by that point anymore. 1989, so... Yeah, by that point, the system had gone national. And when it went national in 1986, they pretty much dropped Rob. Like, the original set was the deluxe set that came with Rob and the Zapper and Gyromite and Duck Hunt. But then, it went national and they went with the action set, which was just Super Mario Brothers. And it was a much better deal. That's the one we got. And it was much more enjoyable. But, like, they never made any more Rob games after 1984, basically. So I don't know if they continued selling Rob. He kind of did his job, which was convince retailers like, oh, we should buy this entertainment system that takes game packs. It's not a video game at all.
I like saying Rob did his job because it sounds like you're trying to get him reelected for something.
Reelect Mayor Robot Operating Buddy. Progress is his middle name.
He'll build all the pillars in the city. I wasn't sure because I had a friend who had Rob, the same friend who had the NES got Rob. I don't know when he got them, but I remember playing Gyromite as a kid, as a two-player competitive game, which was really fun. And one of the great injustices is how the first level Gyromite music is not lauded for how good it is.
Like, all those early NES games. You know, once you got past like the very early sports games, had really good music. It was just like these little simple, catchy loops by I think it was mostly Koji Kondo and Hip Tanaka. I think Rob Jeremiah was Hip Tanaka, and he did such great little like jingles.
Yeah, and he contributed to killing all of those turkeys, which like I was in favor of because they've got those waddles and it's gross.
those things actually have a name. I can't remember what they're called, but. It's some stupid name.
Do you mean like they have like a Christian name? Like each individual one is a murder?
Yes. Exactly.
I know, Jeremy. I feel bad enough, all right?
Rob is actually kind of like Operation Wolf in that if you use the peripheral the game is ostensibly designed for, it's not nearly as much fun as just playing with controllers.
Mm. Yeah, and it ends up becoming... it was really interesting because it's asynchronous co-op. Because one person is controlling the pillars and one person's controlling your little doctor. So it reminded me a little bit of, I mean, there are more recent examples, but when you play Super Mario Galaxy and you have one person gathering the stars for you and kind of helping out in the periphery, it's really neat. Like, it was a really cool way to play a game, and it's the first time I remember doing that.
Yeah, but Rob was, like, complicated and weird. I just bought a Rob for the first time, and I haven't tried it out yet. I'm going to try it out soon. But I really don't get like the idea there. It was honestly, I mean, I was just at a lecture where the designer of the NES said like no one actually understood Rob, and I think he was talking internally at Nintendo.
No, I didn't understand Rob either. I meant with the controller with that. I have a Rob, but for aesthetic purposes, it might as well be a Rob shaped statue.
Oh, you should just get the amiibo. It's much cheaper.
Yeah. Well, now I know that. Now I could do that.
Too late now.
As a Subspace Emissary super fan, I couldn't resist.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So anyway, we were talking about your early video games. You had Operation Wolf and Mega Man 2 and so forth.
Yeah, and for a long time it was just rentals, and that was when my rentals were in the hands of my parents. So I would, you know, be sitting at home, and I'd be like, I love Mega Man, Mega Man's really great, and think that my mom might come home with Mega Man, and I would get, like, Magmax. And that's a very different experience, even though on the surface they look...
Start with MM.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can't really blame her, and she was also doing me a kindness, but again, that didn't stop me from being insufferable about playing Mad Max.
Actually, I was just reading about Mad Max, and it seems really interesting. It's like... They tried to do sort of an open-worldy kind of action game, like the predecessor of modern Mad Max, but I don't know how well it actually worked out.
I might have been, my mushmouth might have got in the way, Mag Max.
Oh, Mag Max. Well, see, that's very confusing, because there was Mag Max, and then there was Mad Max, and they were also very different games. I don't know anything about Mag Max. It was like a kind of an isometric arcade platformer where you're like a flying ship and then you turn into a walking robot if you collect all the parts.
It was a ship where you were a robot that had component parts, but it was a shooter, if I recall. So you went to the right, and as you got more powerful, the game was harder because you had a bigger hitbox. So it's easiest when you're just the ship.
Okay. So if you wanted to be generous, you could say there was a cool risk reward element going on. But mostly it was just like clunky design.
Yeah, it was a lot it was risk. I'm not that generous. Yeah.
No rewards.
Not rewarding.
No rewards worth this.
Really?
So as an old person who used to own an NES, like, to what do you ascribe the continued sustained popularity of the NES? I mean, it's crazy. Like, I would say the system is more popular now than ever, except, you know, at the peak of its sales in the end of the 80s, early 90s, like, games are crazy expensive, and nostalgia is in all kinds of nostalgia just blowing up all over the place.
Yeah, part of it is always when a generation who grew up with something has more purchasing power. That's always going to be a thing that drives demand.
I didn't think millennials had purchasing power.
Some of them apparently do. Yeah, or I mean, we would if we didn't spend all of our money on NES games.
Man, we're doing something wrong if some millennials have money.
I hate us. Somebody do a think piece about this. The library just holds up really well. We had we talked to a guy at the expo this weekend who was doing an interview, and he's like, if a kid wanted to get into retro games, like, what would you start them with old games? And I couldn't think of a better answer than, like, first-party Nintendo stuff from the end of the NES, right? Like, the Kirby, Mario 3, those things are just so amazing, and they don't confuse simplicity with accessibility. You know, they're not simple, they're just accessible, and that's a word that gets a bad rap for no reason. So a lot of the games have that quality that's just really, really special.
They have complexity, but they're not complicated.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And as you get older, it just kind of layers and layers, because if you start looking for weirder kind of hidden gems, they're there. And a lot of my favorite games are ones I accidentally stumbled upon as a kid, like a lot of the adventure games that are on the NES and things like that, that are like not always the best version of those games. But they were just so strange and ill-suited to the system. And now as an adult, I can go back and be like, oh, like, there's a King's Quest for NES, and it's really weird. It's really terrible, but it's really weird. And I can appreciate that on a different level. It's not just how good it is. It's not qualitative. It's also just unusualness is really important.
Yeah, the crazy thing about the NES is that even though it's so well covered and so talked about, there's still all these like crazy deep cuts that even I'm only just learning about. Like, I really want to play the Felix the Cat game now, because
it's really good.
It looks so much like, you know, kind of a Kirby HAL style game. It's developed by Hudson, but clearly they'd gotten a lot better since Mickey Mousecapade.
Yeah, that game's really good. Like, we've covered it for a show, and it was suggested for our Bad Games podcast, and we played it and both realized at the same time, like, this is no way bad. This is a great game. Yeah, there are tons of little gems like that. We just recently played Monster Party, which has a reputation for being super weird, but it's actually really good, too. Like, really interesting. It's not perfect, but it's really interesting, and there's so much of that. You know, I feel like you could play, you know, keep discovering new NES games and make it a project, you know, every day for several years and just come away with so much gold.
Okay, well, I think that's actually my only questions. I can't think of anything else. What else is there to say about NES? We've exhausted it all.
Wonderful music. And then that's just an aesthetic
sometimes
thing.
Sometimes.
I feel like a lot of the time. Like, it's an aesthetic thing, whether you like that kind of soundscape or that sound palette. But if you do, like, I've been just kind of consistently knocked back by how good the music is. Even real weird minimal things, like the other day, and it entered my head, the dungeon music from Dragon Warrior 1, and how, like, just atmospheric and scary it was to me as a kid exploring these dungeons in the dark. You don't know when your torch is going to go out, you know, things like that. So if you like that kind of, if you can tolerate those blips and bloops, like, I think most of that for a system is very good.
All right, thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary.
So I'm here at the Ground Control Arcade with Steve Lin, who actually has never been on Retronauts, but that seems like a huge oversight.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So Steve Lin, big collector for a long time, probably never threw everything away, and just once I started going out into the real world as an adult, I started collecting in earnest and built up a pretty huge collection, NES, Super Nintendo, N64, and a bunch of other.
But I mean, you're not just a collector. Like, no. You have...
I have a job.
Like, you're not just, like, a guy who wants to buy a lot of games. Like,
right. You
really take the time to find sort of the ephemera around games, like the documentation and the marketing materials and things like that. Like, I would love to just, like, pick through your archive sometime. Like, I know it's got to be amazing.
Yeah, I think what happened was during my quest to finish these systems, I met a lot more people, and everybody knew I collected, and that sort of expanded the sphere of influence, I guess. And so people started bringing stranger and stranger things my way, and as collecting just whatever's been released got less interesting, I started moving on to collecting things like, I think one of my most exciting things was the black box games from the Nintendo versus Magnavox court case. So they're black box games, but they have a sticker on it that says Nintendo v. Magnavox court case number, whatever, and they're all signed. And so it's a set of black box games.
That's amazing. So it's like just, you know, retail games, but they were specifically used as evidence in the court, or what?
Yeah, so Magnavox, the legal team, had purchased them and submitted them as evidence. And along with that came paperwork, which is Ralph Baer's handwritten deposition on how Nintendo is infringing on Sanders Associates patents. And they're all dated and, you know, all handwritten notes, and he just did a schematic. They sent him an NES. He broke it apart and said, like, okay, here's where all the patents that they're infringing on. And that was used. These are all used in the case.
That's a court case that's never really talked about. Like, everyone talks about the Universal versus Nintendo case because, like, you know, it's good press. Nintendo basically cleaned the floor with Universal and said, actually, guys, it's not a problem. And you acquired the license to Donkey Kong or King Kong, like, from the public domain. But, the Magnavox case is less known, I think.
Yeah, it was all about the cartridges, basically. You know, can you... that was one of the main thrusts. Is, you know, the Odyssey 1 had interchangeable cartridges. There's a lot of things, I think, related to video display and a few other things. And so it was a big deal. You know, if Nintendo had to pay a royalty on all of these things moving forward, that would have really changed, I think, how they pushed out in the U.S. Mm. That's really interesting. And then I had met with people who had been in Nintendo for a very long time. And, you know, they've told me stories. I have weird things like the script for demonstrating Rob during this launch, actually. So they would have usually, Howard Phillips standing next to Rob and demonstrating how amazing Rob was playing Gyromite. And if you look at the script, there's handwritten notes saying, like, don't do this because then Rob will stop responding, just in case it was someone who wasn't familiar on how to do it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so, I mean, I have a feeling you're going to be on Retronauts a lot in the future. We're gonna drag you in.
Oh, I would love to. I love the show, and it's, you know, whenever I listen to it, sometimes there's people who have this very specific set of skills, I guess, this knowledge about games that's unbelievable. And I think I have some of that in some areas, but it's always entertaining to hear about what people have really kind of jumped into and made their passion.
But yeah, we're here, you know, kind of on the actual 30th anniversary of the NES's launch in the U.S. I don't know who exactly figured out that it was October 18th, 1985. Was that Frank Cifaldi?
I think we're going to go with Frank Cifaldi on this one. He's the one that's done the most research in terms of finding, yeah, like ads and, you know, trade magazines, any press coverage. I think he has that first review of Super Mario Brothers from those two women who ran a newsletter, just trying to track down exactly which date. And I guess we could look at what day, this day was in 1985, just to figure out, does that make sense that they would do it on a Tuesday or whatever it is.
But, I mean, given the amount of work he's put into it, and it just seems to be kind of like, now this is the accepted thing, October 18th, 1985.
Yeah.
So here we are, 30 years later, which is kind of crazy. I actually, you know, I wasn't in New York at the time, so I didn't experience the NES until probably a year later. But it sounds like, my understanding is that you actually did have some familiarity with the system, like an encounter with it right around the time of the launch.
So I had actually seen the Famicom before the NES had launched. And so...
You were just a little kid at the time, though, right?
I was a kid, but my family was in Taiwan, and we had relatives in Japan. And so we had visited them, I think, the year prior, so 1984. And I had seen the system, and of course I didn't know who Nintendo was. Well, I knew Nintendo Game & Watch, I guess. And we're like, wow, this is great. And I had played Super Mario Brothers and a few other games. And then when I had heard, some of this was Playground, but then this is going to be a strange thing, but my parents encouraged me to examine the companies that I found interesting because someday I might want to invest in them. And so this is when I'm 8, 9 years old. It's, hey, here's this company, Activision.
You can bring the future
there. Right. You know, Activision, you know, this is how they make money. And, you know, is this something that you're going to want to invest in when you grow older? So I was following things like CES news, casually, and then saying, like, hey, there's this new game system from Nintendo. I was like, isn't that the system we played in Taiwan? And, you know, it wasn't available where I grew up in Ohio, but it was in early 86. So that's when I was first exposed to the NES, and that was the deluxe set.
So what was your experience there?
With the NES was I started looking for the games that we had played when we were in Taiwan. So Super Mario Brothers, fortunately, was very recognizable, but a lot of them I had only known the Chinese or Japanese name, and so we're kind of looking at the back, like, oh, is that the one who played? And then there was things that, you know, obviously we had never been exposed to, so it was still a lot of the shot in the dark, like, okay, this game looks good, Urban Champion, this guy's fighting on the cover, this must be awesome.
Sorry.
Yeah, that was a real disappointing, like, I was thinking it would, for some reason, gonna be like, ER Kung Fu type, you know, it's like maybe there's more jumping or something like that, and just, no, it wasn't that.
Yeah, that was more like the Kung Fu game, actually.
Yeah.
Irem's Kung Fu Master, which was based on a Jackie Chan movie, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, in Japan it was called Spartan X, and it was based on a Jackie Chan movie. If you look at the Japanese box art, it's like a cartoon version of Jackie Chan.
Oh, wow.
But in the U.S., they just completely skipped over all that. They just called it Kung Fu.
It was Kung Fu Master in the U.S. in the arcade.
Right.
Yeah.
I think also in Europe it was Kung Fu Master, but on NES it was just Kung Fu. Like,
right.
They just
yep.
cut right to the chase. But yeah, like, so that was probably more what you were expecting.
Yeah,
I was talking to Frank Cifaldi yesterday, and earlier in this episode actually, mentioned the fact that the first exposure I had to the NES was Kung Fu. Yeah, maybe if, you know, my first exposure had been Urban Champion, I would have been like, well, okay,
maybe
I'll
not.
Stick with ColecoVision.
Yeah, so I had a ColecoVision as well, and so that was sort of the game system. And we had a computer, so for me, this was like much
like
more...
Like the ColecoAtom or a separate computer?
Oh, no, we had a separate PC, because my father did economic forecasting, so we always had fastest computer with the worst video card, because he just needed the processor, and so I was like, we have to get a VGA card. This is years later. But, you know, what I tried to do, when we first saw the NES, we knew what it was because we had played it. The one thing that was confusing was the totally different color scheme and, you know, the cartridges and everything like that. So I think that was probably the most confusing. We're like, is this the same thing? It's the same company. And then once we'd played Mario, we're like, oh, yeah, this is the same thing. We actually did try to have our cousin send us some games. Not realizing that we weren't able to play them in the NES. Different pin configuration. And we're like, wait, those were smaller. And then I think we actually had a game stuck inside the NES. We're like shaking it to try to get out. Like, maybe there's a way to get this out. So, yeah.
Yeah, actually, at the Masayuki Uemura presentation at NYU a few days ago, he said, like, you know, like, we designed the NES cartridges to be more like VHS cartridges, specifically because we came up with that top-loading design to kind of trick retailers into saying, oh, this isn't a video game system, it's an entertainment system.
Right.
So, like, they had to make the game cartridges bigger because Famicom cartridges were so tiny, they were, like, half the size, they would get stuck inside that top loader, or, like, someone reaching in would accidentally touch the pins or something.
Oh, yeah.
So it was, like, a deliberate design decision to make the cartridges bigger in the U.S.
Our big American hands just, like, pulling it.
Right. It's funny, though, that you, like, actually have experienced this thing he was talking about firsthand.
Right. Well, you know, we're young, and our cousin's like, hey, here's the game. And like, okay, well, if we push it deep enough, it'll fit, right? And we didn't do things like compare the size of the pins or anything. We're like, okay, this must work in there. And then like kind of rattle this machine to get it out. It's interesting you bring up the design change, because I do have the AVS brochure, which was that brochure where it is
probably
the
most interesting facet of like the pre-launch NES aspect. Like, the fact that they had this like entirely different system in mind that they presented to the public and said, like, hey, here's this console we're going to do, and everyone kind of said, I don't know, it's kind of like the ColecoAtom, we don't really care.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is, like, in that brochure, there's, like, the keyboard attachment, the musical keyboard attachment, and then they call the Zapper, like, a light wand, because it actually, you know, kind of looked like a lightsaber with the back that sort of twisted down. And it's like, okay, well, there's this light one. Yeah, wireless controllers, all kinds of really strange things. You know, 1 year later from that CES for sure, they actually were pushing out the NES. So that's not a very long time to do a pretty radical redesign of the system.
Yeah, the AVS, like the brochures that I've seen and everything, like that looked way more kind of like the 80s vision of futuristic than the NES, which was much more kind of grounded in the actual, you know, home appliances of the era.
Yeah, it kind of, the way I put it, sometimes it almost looked like a, one of those remote controls from the future. Even if you look at the D-pad, right, it's not a D-pad, it's that square-looking thing. And square buttons, I think, just like the square button Famicom. So they really...
And the, you know, the square D-pad is something that Sega actually went with the Master System.
Yeah, in fact, it looks like a silver square D-pad, right? So I obviously, I never saw that brochure, and I only obtained it maybe 2 years ago. But reading through that, you can see how they were trying to position the NES as, hey, this isn't like that video game stuff that crashed, you know, a couple years ago, trying to wipe away memories. This is a whole family entertainment system that's been meant to compete with this new computer revolution that we're entering. So,
yeah, so the keyboard attachment, you said it's a musical keyboard, so it's not the same as like the Famicom basic keyboard. It's a different kind of keyboard altogether?
Yeah, it's actually a piano keyboard.
But it's not the Miracle keyboard.
No, it's not. It's much smaller. I don't think I've actually counted the number of keys on it, but they're like, look forward to this, you know, musical, you know, creation software and things like that, which is really strange.
Yeah, so it's interesting that they did experiment with this entirely different take, not just a different design of the NES through the AVS, but like a different philosophy of release. I mean, it really was, you know, in Japan you had the Famicom, which was short for Family Computer, and they really did treat it like a computer. You had, like, initially, you know, I mean, the first 2 years you had the Famicom basic system, so you could program on the Famicom with a keyboard, and there was like a cassette.
Yeah,
there was like the data system, or the data, Famicom data. Was it called data system?
I think
so. It was like a tape cassette, and you could use it to record, like, you know, level designs, custom tracks, and Excitebike, or Lode Runner even. Like, there was third-party support for it. And they looked at bringing most of that to the U.S., I think, but for whatever reason, they eventually just decided, no, just make a game console with a robot.
Yeah, I think, well, it was probably pushing towards the toy. You know, that's really where we bought a lot of our video games, right?
Yeah.
It was like toy retailers, so if you wanted to be on the shelves of, you know, Kitty City or Children's Palace or Toys R Us, you really had to say, like, what is this thing? And, you know, at the time, like, at my booth at Retro Gaming Expo, I had a lot of the Tomy Omnibots, and everybody was just taking pictures
and
everything.
I love that. Like, I saw your booth without realizing it was your booth as I was kind of making my rounds initially yesterday, and I saw the Omnibot 2000 that you had just out on display, and I was like, whoa, that's like a huge mock-up of, oh, no, it's the Omnibot.
Yeah, and I think they were really, there's a reaction that everybody had as soon as they saw the Omnibot, and they wanted to take pictures with it, and, like, I remember seeing that in, like, the Sears catalog or the Wish book, and I think
Didn't they have one of those in Silver Spoons, the TV show? It was, like, serving drinks and stuff.
Think Silver Spoons, and everybody compared it to the Polly's robot in Rocky. And, you know, it's kind of reminded them of that era, and I think, you know, Rob really sort of pushed those buttons for a lot of people. It's like, look at this robot that looks at the TV and plays a game with me. It doesn't really matter if it works or not. It's just one of those cool things that you want in your house. It's like, I want the system with the robot. You know, no other system has a robot. Unless it's like Axelon Andy or something like that. So
in your mind, what is the most interesting thing about the original NES launch? Like the, you know, let's say the initial test period from October 1985 through summer 1986 when it finally hit national distribution. What's, like, to you, what really stands out of all the things you've read and seen and experienced yourself firsthand?
Well, I think for Nintendo, it was a huge risk. And they pretty much had all their eggs in this basket. And just to see how much traction they were able to get with no advertising. You know, a lot of this, you know, obviously local market advertising we're seeing in magazines and things like that. But, you know, if you think about, like, what a console launch looks like now versus what something looked like in 1985, you know, when the Atari 5200 was being announced, I knew that that system was coming out. They were advertising, like, the new Atari, and here's all the games, and there's in-store displays and things like that. With Nintendo, it was almost like a slow burn, right? It's like, hey, we're starting in New York. Hey, let's expand to L.A., and then gradually sort of that word of mouth starts to get out. It's like, wait a minute, there's this like new game system and look at these graphics, right? And maybe you're catching it in a magazine that's reviewing stereos or something like that, or, you know, all you see is the belly, or maybe not that, like, you know, you're going through the clearance bin and then you start seeing, like, maybe there's something coming up, right? And I think the, like, playground gossip, you know, my cousin in New York has this thing that's amazing, and During that period of time, they were able to support a nationwide launch. And, you know, 86, just, things took off almost right as soon as they, went national. Right.
Yeah, to me, it's all kind of vague because I didn't realize, like, oh, this is a big new thing. Yeah, my family bought a ColecoVision, a Coleco Atom, after the console market crash. Mm-hmm. So it was super cheap. But, like, to me, video games at that point, like, when I was shopping for games, they were either something you had to buy in a catalog because no one had them, or you had to dig through this, like, remainder bin at, like, a convenience store or something, like a Five and Dime. There would just be this big pile of games. All of a sudden, the Nintendo, the NES came along, and all of a sudden, games were back behind the counter. There was, like, a row, rows and rows of them, and you could, like, look at, a dozen, 15, 20 games that you could buy, and they were all way out of my price range as a 10-year-old, but, like, it did kind of strike me as, like, oh, video games, like, they're a thing again.
Yeah, I think, I never stopped playing console games because we also had a ColecoVision and a 2600, and so the crash for me was amazing because all these games are a dollar, and I'm just hey, my allowance, I can buy five games, this is great.
There was, like, a catalog where you could buy ColecoVision or Coleco Atom games. It was, like, $10 a peach, which was a lot for me at the time, but not nearly as much as the $30 they wanted for Nintendo games. To me, that was amazing because I could get Donkey Kong or Donkey Kong Jr., and they came in these boxes that were shaped like arcade consoles.
Yeah, they had the arcade.
It was great. I was like, yeah. But there was, like, this sea change when NES came along.
Yeah, well, it's funny, the Coleco had all those Exidy titles, which I had never seen. It's like, Venture, yeah, okay, there's an arcade machine on there and must be out in arcades. It's not mine, right? Or Looping or something like that. I was buying a bunch of games. We were playing some things on PC. And I think what really struck me, and this is only struck me years later, was I was buying games for, $1, $5, whatever, in these clearance bins. And then the NES came out, and when we got that, I thought I could see the quality difference. And I think Nintendo's strategy of obviously limiting the number of titles that could come out was extremely successful because I had been burned by a lot of terrible games. Fortunately, it only cost me a dollar. But, during 81, 82, people were spending, $30, $40 on those things. And so for us, it was like, it was worth it. Like, yes, I could buy 30, 2600 games for the price of one, Urban Champion. But in this case...
That was the exception.
Yeah, the exception, right? And I think what also helped really... soon after was the rental market exploded, right? Mm-hmm. So we were able to sample things for the same price as, like in a 20. And if we really liked it, we could buy it. And I know that Nintendo had fought the video rental market as well, but I really think that's what helped make it less risky for people to buy into the Nintendo. It's like, okay, before I spend $40, my kid can play it, and if he likes it, we'll buy it for Christmas. So those two things, I think, go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what else I want to say. For me, like, I didn't really get into NES until a few years after it had launched and really kind of gone nationwide because I had to save up for it. But it was definitely, like, once I saw, that demo of Kung Fu, it was always kind of, like, on my mind, like, Nintendo was a thing. And, I knew Nintendo games before that because I had played, Donkey Kong from back in the day, and I had played Punch-Out, and I saw that in the arcades, and it was just the coolest looking game. It had two screens.
Yeah, Punch-Out.
And it was just like these giant cartoon characters. So, like, even, the arcade equivalent of the Love Tester. I don't remember exactly what it was, but, like, I had seen Nintendo's name all over the arcades. I had played Popeye. I didn't think it was that great, but, like, it was a cool-looking game that looked like Popeye. So Nintendo had some cachet with me already, and then the system came along, and I was like, okay, Nintendo, this is a thing. So, yeah, it was, like, this object I coveted for a long time until I could finally get it. And, I think all of that kind of, like, added up to help build my affection for the system. But, in the end, it was, like, I bought the system, and then there were all these great games to play, and I spent so much time playing them. Like, it wasn't just hype. It was actually delivered.
Yeah, I think one of the moments for me, I think, that was really important was when I bought Mega Man. So I bought Mega Man 1 with a ton of money from mowing lawns and everything else. And even though that cover, the really infamous cover, I looked at the back and like, wow, this kind of looks, like a Japanese game or something, that we were playing in Asia. And I bought it, and I loved Mega Man 1. I told everybody on the playground about it. It's like, you have to play this game, and then come over, and like, this game is amazing. It's like, and why is the cover so terrible? but I think the NES was one of those systems that, because we had this prior experience, like, my family knew that this is a game system that is also big in Asia, unlike like the Atari or ColecoVision. And like, okay, they're still making games, and there's a lot of games, so we'll buy this one because we don't think there's going to be a crash. We were able to invest in it early, but I still had to buy games myself, and I basically walked around my neighborhood asking anybody who needed their, you know, walkway shoveled or lawn mowed just to raise enough money to try out, you know, some of these new games. And for me, I think that's the thing. Like, I had to put in a lot of like sort of blood, sweat, and tears. And if a game was bad, well, usually we tried to rent it first, but sometimes you just had to take that shot in the dark. And it's just, for me growing up, if I wasn't eating, sleeping, or at school, I was probably either, you know, playing Nintendo or mowing lawns. And you know, that's why I love it so much. And you know, when I was looking to collect every single game in the system, there was an element of, I'm fulfilling the 10, 12-year-old dream, right? Like, when I was a kid.
Finally owning Jeopardy 25th Anniversary Edition.
Yes, yeah, you know, Wheel of Fortune featuring Vanna White. You know, I just needed that. For me, it was, and that's also the reason I collect Complete in Box, is because, you know, you mentioned you went into the store and you saw those things behind the counter, like, video games are back. That was the thing. You know, World of Nintendo, when they started that store display, I wanted my room to look like World of Nintendo. I was like, can we get like black, like, you know, steel mesh or something and put it on the walls and like red signage? And that was something, you know, that I grew up with. And I wanted that store look. Now, once it actually happened, I'm like, okay, that's probably not what I should have gone for. But it was really interesting at the time.
Yeah, I totally had that same affection for the boxes. Like, I was one of those rare kids who actually kept his NES boxes and kept his games in the boxes. And they fit perfectly in shoe boxes.
Yeah.
Like, you would put them in and line them up, then you just pop the lid open and take the game out. And to me, that was, you know, part of it was like, there was this great packaging around it, and you could look inside, and there was a manual. I don't get people who throw stuff away. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I had the same reaction. You know, when I was a little kid, I had my ColecoVision and Atari boxes, and when I got out of Atari, I was like, where did you get this box? Like, oh, I just never threw it away. So this is the one I actually got for Christmas.
Yeah, for me, like, every video game that I bought in the NES era was hard-earned with the same way as you. It was like going around mowing lawns and painting my grandparents' house or whatever, like, just doing all this kind of hard labor to earn enough money to, like, buy a $40 video game. So I treated them as precious. You know, I had friends who just had, like, dozens of games. Their parents just bought them games all the time. They'd chuck the boxes and the manuals, and they would just have, like, a line of cartridges. It's like, I don't know. It's like, it's, I'll borrow these from you. That's great, but I feel like you're missing something here.
Yeah. The NES, I think, especially for, you know, folks around our age, it's when it launched, I think we had had some experience with video games, right? We had played games in the arcade. We had seen the first boom, and so we knew how awesome arcades could be, or how awesome games could be. And Nintendo was like that validation. You know, when you started seeing, you know, the TV, like, Nintendo, the hottest gift of the Christmas season, it's like, yes, we never left, I think. And I'm really glad that, you know, they got to where they were. Yeah, there's a lot of business practices that were really aggressive, but I also think it resulted, at least in the beginning, in really making the market where it is today. You know, without that level of control, I think we could have spun into just another crash right away.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo almost dealt with that in Japan.
Yeah.
Like, initially, there was no control over the licensees, and, you know, there's some magazine articles that have been translated from, like, 1986 or so, where people are just like, oh, yeah, the Famicom is just full of garbage. You never really had that here. I mean, yeah, there were lots of bad games released in America, but it wasn't the majority of the market.
Right.
It really felt like, especially, you know, in the early years, like, it was good games. You had to really kind of go out of your way to find something that was complete trash.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, you couldn't have people putting out pirated carts, right? Like, you said, I mean, Atari, anybody could pretty much make a cartridge. In fact, we had friends that had a gutted Atari cartridge with a Ziff socket, right? Just, like, hot glued on top, and they were pirating our Atari games like in 81, 82.
Wow.
So we didn't see that with the Nintendo, so you had to buy sort of until, you know, Color Gene, Tengen, and everything else. But, you know, that early on stage, it was one of those things, like, once you started, I guess the disc system introduced a lot of piracy in Japan, and then obviously, you know, all those Taiwanese, Chinese carts that are amazing today because of their unbelievable, terrible artwork. But yeah, that's sort of a kitsch collector.
I love that people are pirating those old pirate games. There was someone at the Retro Game Expo today who had a like fake copy of Super Mario. And like it was done up like a black box game, but
oh, wow.
But the actual artwork was like this really low resolution blurry screenshot of Super Mario, which was, you know, I think most people kind of cite that as the first pirated, like unlicensed NES game or Famicom game.
Right.
It was like the first kind of illegal. It was like a hack of Super Mario Brothers, but with like a girl as the lead character, and there was kind of like some sort of, I wouldn't say pornographic, but kind of racy
sexiness.
Content.
Yeah.
So that's kind of become its own thing. Like the original Super Mario sells for like $800 or something in Japan. So like there's even a market. Like the NES is a big enough thing that there is a market for bootlegs.
Yeah, bootlegs, and even some of the early homebrews, like Garage Kart, right? It has that. The games aren't very good, but that cart sells for, you know, $2,000 because it was the first NES homebrew, right? Mm-hmm. And something like, oh, wow, this kind of kicked off this whole revolution of all these homebrew games. It's interesting, on the pirated thing, one thing I remember was looking through our classified ad section. This is in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And one was like, I think it said like 152 Nintendo games for $2.99, right? And so my child brain is doing the math and like, oh, that's $2 a game. I could keep the games I want and just sell off the rest. And then, like, that's the greatest deal of all time. And of course, the number you call, and you call, it's like, oh, what are the games? And I'm listing off some of the games. Obviously, this is those like multi carts. And then they drop the bomb that it's all on one cartridge.
Oh.
And you're like, no, oh, I can't spend $300. That's like, I who does that, right? So, but yeah, got really excited. And I think that. One thing that that happened with the NES that I had not seen with Atari and ColecoVision was people really trying to share a lot of secrets in the games. Mm-hmm. You know, the playground talk wasn't just, what's your score? It was more like the, oh, my cousin saw Zelda in Metroid if you go through the right series of doors and things like that. And so it fostered more a collaboration, mm-hmm. Than just like straight score competition.
Yeah, that was totally my mornings in junior high school, was sitting around before school started and like trying to figure out how to get through the Lost Woods in Zelda, or like people telling me about these crazy secrets they found in Castlevania, or, you know, like who even knows, it was probably like a glitch or something, but like that was what we talked about. And it really was this kind of like community thing where it was about discovery and about sharing and about exploring these worlds together, even though we weren't playing together in the same space.
Yeah, we had one guy this is in junior high. He actually was the first person to get and finish Legend of Zelda. And he had drawn maps on graph paper on how to get through.
Yeah, I always did that too. Yeah,
and he was using the school's photocopier to sell copies of his maps.
Wow!
I think
there.
Yeah, it was like, I think like, man, 50 cents, which was like half of your lunch money. So you'd basically skip lunch or something to get the Zelda. I didn't buy it because I was like, I want to play through it. But definitely there was kids like buying his Zelda maps. I don't know if he's like working for one of the strategy guide companies nowadays. Like found his calling early on.
So with all this said, like, what do you think is the future of the NES? I mean, it's 30 years old, but people like, in some ways it's more popular now than it's ever been. Where do you think it goes from here?
I think it really depends on what Nintendo decides to do with the games and the property, right? You can see them pulling on some of the nostalgia threads to bring things back. I think Mario Maker has really brought, has really helped, I think, not only just Nintendo now in terms of finances, but also people remembering, wow, you know, these games were fantastic, and designing a level is really hard. I think there's a newfound appreciation for what Nintendo would put out, because even trying to make something like a cohesive level is very difficult. You know, people are doing those troll levels and like autoplays. So for the NES, it's what can they do to have to continue to allow people to play that library, right? You know, here at Retro Gaming Expo, we have, you can buy an NES or like a Retron 5 or something and plug in a cartridge. I really wish there were a service kind of like Netflix, right, where you can, you know, download a game and, you know, play it for a little bit and sort of, it doesn't make sense financially. I know why they're not doing that, like a subscription service, but, you know, having people's earliest experiences with some of these levels, I think there's always going to be a warm place in people's heart for the NES. If Nintendo keeps it as part of our consciousness with things like Mario Maker or, you know, like Zelda Dungeon Creator or whatever they want to do, I think that, you know, it's going to be here. It's always going to be, for us, it's always going to be there. I think for kids, they're going to identify with Mario, with the characters, not necessarily the system. So.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Cool.
Great conversation.
Yeah. Thanks.
Appreciate it. So finally, we'll wrap up this episode by bringing in the other host. How exciting.
Finally here. Hello, everybody. Thanks. Coming to you live from an Airbnb.
Thanks for joining us, Bob, or joining me, I guess.
Okay.
Maybe I'm Legion. yeah, anyway, so yeah, we're kind of wrapping up the NES 30th anniversary celebration, hootenanny. And it occurs to me that I don't really know what kind of history you personally have with the NES. That's something I've talked about a lot. I think a lot of people on the show have talked about, but I don't know that you've ever just like said, you know, here's where I discovered the NES. I mean, was it even that big a deal for you?
I think I talked about it on the Super Mario Brothers episode a little bit, where I had a 2600 in my house, and it was like this thing I would tinker with, but, you know, Mario changed my life. I played it, and it was like, this is what I do now. But it was actually, like, it's kind of dark, my history with the NES. And I was thinking about this when I was in the when I was just hanging out this morning, and I was like, the NES could have, like, saved my childhood, I think. Because, how do I say this? Well, my mom left a very abusive husband. Not to get too serious on this episode of Retronauts.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder if this was a good topic.
No, I want to talk about this. I'm not going to give any details or anything like that, but we lived with my grandma for a while. And it was kind of rough because it was like a new school, a new place, a new setting, new people. And I believe my grandma was the one who got me the Nintendo because, like, they wanted me to be able to fit in with kids and everything like that. So I think, like, that helped a lot because I don't remember ever being that sad or traumatized or anything like that. I just always had something to do and something to play, and we all played Nintendo together. And
So when you say it could have saved your childhood, what you mean is like it may have saved your childhood.
Yeah, it could be irresponsible.
It wasn't like if only I had an NES. Yeah.
It could be responsible, but I've talked about this a few times before, but like if you're a little kid and your mom is dating other guys, you immediately dislike them or you're immediately suspicious. But my current stepdad, who's been my stepdad for, I don't know, 25 years now, or 20 years, I don't know. Wait, 25, yeah. The first thing my mom told me about him was that he played Nintendo. And he is a huge nerd, and he still is. But that was immediately, like, the bargaining chip that was that made me immediately accept him. So, like, I think that, like, Nintendo helped me not have a bad childhood. In a not super serious way. But, like, it helped me adjust to a new life, and it helped me adjust to a new dad. So, yeah. So that's my super dark past with the NES.
That's actually not that dark. It's actually kind of, I don't know if uplifting, but at least
it makes a case for video games not being entirely detrimental to human happiness and development.
Yeah, and my mom, to her credit, was never dismissive of video games. She played them with me up to a point, and she always supported everything I do with them. So, yeah, like, I just have nothing. I mean, maybe that's why I'm so attached to Nintendo, because it's like I do associate it with that rough time and getting through it. But yeah, that's basically my past in terms of like where I found it. But the Mario episode has like the like not emotional side of it, like the okay. like where it clicked in my brain, but this is more like where it fit into my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I do find it interesting that you're not that much older than me, but you're 7 years older than me, I think.
That's and, pretty old.
Well, but the thing is, like, I think it's pretty interesting that we both were as obsessed with the same thing, but I was 8 and you were a teenager. So I don't know, I just found that interesting, like, that broad of an appeal for something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the Nintendo was the chance I finally had to own a video game system. It was one of those things that we didn't have the money for growing up. So I, you know, we would get, like, remnant leftover systems. You know, circa 1983, my father came home with a dedicated Pong system. So, you know, not really at the cutting edge. There was one time he brought home some, like, self-contained Atari computer. It was like a modular console with a membrane keyboard, but we couldn't get it to work. It would just, like, we tried to boot it up and it would come on and give us a prompt, but we couldn't get anything to run on it.
That's why the market crashed.
So, yeah. So, you know, eventually we did get a ColecoVision after the market crashed and it was really cheap, but it always, you know, there was kind of this sense of, like, well, this is dead, because to buy games, I had to buy them from a catalog, like a mail order catalog. Jeez. So
it's like you're buying seeds or something.
Yeah, it was kind of like post apocalyptic. So so the Nintendo, you know, was like my chance to finally be sort of with it. And all my friends played video games. You know, they all had Nintendos except the one weird guy who had the Master System.
You don't talk about him.
No, it was fine. He tried to show off the snail game as if that was something amazing. Like, my console has a snail maze built into it.
I bet if you talk to him 10 years later, he'd show you the snake game on his phone.
I don't know about that. But yeah, I'd go over to his house and play some of the cool stuff that was on Master System that the NES didn't have. But otherwise, it was like a communal thing. Like, me and my friends... My friends and I all would hang out and, you know, share video game chat, tips and
oh, yeah.
concepts and swap games back and forth and so on.
That was part of it for me, too. Like, everybody was obsessed with Nintendo, boys, girls. Like, I was in a club, as you are when you're a kid. You just form your own little clubs. It wasn't a street gang or anything, but we were doing this for years. We would just design our own Nintendo games, and what it would just be like drawings of what we wanted them to be. But we took it very seriously. Like, we would just sit down and just crank out these ideas for games. I can't remember any of them, but I knew we did it for years, and I wish I held on to some of those things. But, like, we were all obsessed. And, yeah, it was a magical time to be alive.
So something I've been talking to all the different guests on this episode about is, you know, the actual launch of the NES, the test launch in New York City 30 years ago. Or, you know, maybe after that, like, as the system became... you know, available nationally. Like, what was the point at which you became aware of the NES?
I think I have vague memories of... Well, of course I knew what an Atari was, because we had that. It seemed to always be there. But I was at some relative's house, and it was watching people play Kung Fu, I think. That was the first time I saw an NES. I was like, this is different. Like, the things look like things, not just, like, random shapes that scare me sometimes. So it must have been, like, 86 or 87. I was probably, like, 4 years old, so the memories are kind of foggy. But
right.
then I knew what it was, and that's when you could not really avoid Nintendo stuff. Around, like, 87, 88, that's when it was started showing up with, like, Nintendo Power and magazines, and I started meeting kids that had it. So that's where it really found me, like, just a few years after this soft launch.
So, in a sense, Nintendo has been a home console... factor for as long as you can remember, like, literally.
Yeah, it's like it could be kind of insidious how it's wormed its way into my life, and you can kind of the whole Nintendo Power thing was a little questionable, even if it was fun, but I sometimes question if my attachment to Nintendo is like honest, or it's something that they did to me. But I still can say I love the games regardless, but just my obsession that continues today I don't know.
I think Nintendo did a pretty good job of, you know, like, social engineering in terms of marketing, but I don't think they actually, like, implanted, you know, chips into our minds or anything like that.
It wasn't
had enough chip shortages as it was.
I mean, it wasn't as like, insidious as, like, Happy Meals, where it's like, we're going to teach you to love our food by giving you toys. But, I don't know. I guess they just made it more legitimate for kids because it's like, oh, there are books about these things, and these are ways for us to talk about these things, so... And, like, just spreading information before the internet was really hard to do. So, like, I remember I had the Pack Watch guide, which was, like, here's a list of every Nintendo game. And I grew up with a single mom for a long time, so, like, I didn't get that many video games. So, of course, when I was told about this future stepdad and his love for Nintendo, the first thing I did when I got to his house was he had, like, all of these games I'd never seen before. So, like, just having read about them in Nintendo Power, I was ready. I was like, oh, I've heard about this, and I wanted to play them all. So, yeah. And that's where I found Jaws.
Jaws?
Yeah.
Oh,
I played a lot
of
Jaws. Yeah, I don't know. We did an episode about it, so.
Yeah, that's one of those kind of, like, games that was probably better than it should have been.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that on Nintendo, on NES.
It's like an RPG with one town and three enemies.
Mm.
And basically, that's what it is, but they didn't get much further than that. So it's a good first chapter to what could have been like a weird Jaws RPG.
Well, it was developed by Atlus.
That is true,
so,
yeah.
It's that and Friday the 13th also.
Yeah. I want to see them return to the Jaws RPG. Maybe they could do a Persona crossover.
I mean, Etrian Odyssey 3 was kind of the Jaws RPG.
Really? Oh, yeah, because
yeah,
you have a ship.
Hearing,
yeah.
Yeah.
I got it.
Yeah, yeah. And the first boss, it, like, disappears beneath the water, and it's like a crawfish or something, but... No, it's a catfish. That's what it was.
They're going
a
back to their
catfish.
Roots.
Yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but it's a totally insubstantial connection that means nothing whatsoever, but it's fun to find patterns where none exist.
But I will say that for all the Nintendo stuff I was obsessed with, I had one chance to rent The Wizard, and my mom rented something else, and I'm glad I never saw The Wizard, because it could have ruined my Nintendo love. I don't think I would have enjoyed it.
Even if you got the secret of the warp whistle in Super Mario Bros. 3?
You know what? I probably would have known about that ahead of time. These were the video days. I don't even think like seeing it in a theater was an option for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Are there any like unfulfilled wishes or ambitions you have when it comes to NES games? Like things you wish you had done that you haven't gotten around to doing yet?
Oh, geez. I'd like to finish Zelda 2 one day in my life, but every time I try, it's very disheartening. But there are kind and smart people out there who are doing ROM hacks of notoriously hard games, and I am going to now play through Fester's Quest, or at least try, because there's a new, this is going out soon, but somebody hacked it so that it basically cuts out a few of the really unfair design choices.
Yeah, your bullets can pass through walls now.
Yeah, and I think like getting hit once doesn't take away all of your power-ups you've obtained up to that point, because that's what it did. Like, you would slowly, gradually upgrade your gun, but one hit, you'd be back to your little pea shooter.
Yeah, that's a really interesting case. I don't know if you've ever read the interview with the American producer of the game.
No.
But it was kind of this early attempt at East-West collaboration. There was, you know, there was a real divide between Japanese, American, European developers back in the day, and you would have, like, Rare, who was kind of ubiquitous on NES as developers, but, you know, they worked in their little studio in Tweecross, and that's what they did. They made games for people. You didn't really see a lot of collaboration, but Fester's Quest was actually an attempt by American Sunsoft employees to work with Japanese Sunsoft employees.
Oh, wow, okay.
And so the concept of the game, the design, even the fact that they were like, let's make a game about an Adams Family character, that was all... the result of the American team, like, all their ideas.
Mm.
And then they would come up with these documents and send them over to the Japan team, and the Japan team would execute and turn them into video games. And a lot of the problems with the game have to do with the fact that communication on an international scale was so slow back then that they didn't really have time to fine-tune it. So things like the lack of checkpoints and the punishing difficulty, like, they just didn't have time to playtest the game. So because of that that lack of communication, the slow communication between the two teams, that's why that game is not very good. So I kind of feel like a hack of that game is actually in the spirit of the game, because it's like it wasn't quite finished when it was released.
So I guess that is what I want to do now. I can't think of anything else, but like Fester's Quest always intrigued me as a kid because I just would hit a wall in that first sewer, and the game is like 8 times bigger than that. So it's just like, what else is in this game? Like it seems so huge at the time.
And
I'm sure
it doesn't have continues, does it?
It doesn't. No. Yeah, when you die, you go back to the very. Okay. Yeah, that's another problem too. So I don't know if they hacked that part out, but I think maybe with the other changes, you don't need that part hacked out. But I'm looking forward to more people doing more things like that to make these like nearly impossible games playable. The impossible games with promise, not just like bad games. Mm. Yeah.
You haven't ever played Zelda 2 with save states or, like, you know, on Virtual Console?
I did, but the Virtual Console I played it on was the Wii one, and it didn't have save states. It had some weird half-step that never really worked, so...
It was just a suspend feature.
Yeah, so maybe if it's on, like... Is it on 3DS?
Mm-hmm. It's on everything.
Okay. Maybe I'll try it that way.
It's playable that way, yeah. I beat it the proper way back in the day, but I don't have that kind of patience and... long-suffering sensibility these days, so
yeah.
I replayed it with save states, and it's much more tolerable that way.
My biggest problem, and I wrote an article about it for your website like 8 or 9 years ago, was about how much work they make you do if you die, like how far they throw you back, where it's like you're not learning anything, they're just punishing you by making you do things again. So if I could just do like a little cheat save, like, okay, I'm going to save at the start of the dungeon, and I can always go back to this. I don't want to be like saving every 5 seconds. I want to make like an honest, like, if I was designing the game now, here's where I would put a save point, and I would just do it like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the NES, is that it was kind of this... like this learning phase of video games. You went from very simple arcade games, single screens and that sort of thing, like very simple score objectives, to much more complex and elaborate concepts. The NES wasn't the only system that was happening on, but it definitely was the most popular and most successful and most published for. So you did have a lot of people, including Nintendo, figuring out what works and what doesn't. And, you know, there's a lot of differences between the Japanese version of Zelda 2 and the American version. Mm-hmm. They made a lot of refinements and changed the way the experience system works and changed the, like, some of the sprites and other things. It didn't have to do with the change of platforms. It was just, like, they made the game better as they kind of went along. And you still see that sort of thing, like, with, you know, Square Enix's RPGs, where they release, like, the Japanese version and then the refined American version, and then they re-release that in Japan as a kind of double dip. That sort of evolutionary process was something that I think you really first saw on NES. Mm-hmm. So it really was kind of this formative, transitional, and also evolutionary platform.
There's also some other things I would like to do, but I can't think of there are a ton of translations I need to play. Like, there's so many coming out that no one even thinks about, because that scene is kind of much smaller than it used to be. But I really want to play through Sweet Home at some point, because it seems like a really cool idea that I need to just sit down and have the patience to try it out. So that's the Resident Evil predecessor, basically, if you guys haven't heard of it. And so, someone just told me they bought a copy today, and I was like, I need to play that.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm kind of interested right now in exploring the Famicom disk system and kind of like seeing these other versions of games that I know really well. Like, I know some of the obvious ones, yeah, the difference in music in Zelda, or the fact that Castlevania and Section Z have save slots, and so they're much easier in Japan. But there's just like this entire sort of subcategory of NES games that's very, very obscure. And I'm sure most Famicom Disk System games are not very good. The ones Square Enix published under the Disk Operating Group label were so bad that it almost put the company out of business, and probably deservedly so.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are a lot of interesting gems out there to be explored. It's like 170 games, so there's a pretty big library to pick from.
And I also want to play Portopia. All three of them.
That's been fan translated.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't. It's like a trilogy. I know the first one has been, but I don't know about the other two. But I think even if it is super primitive, I just want to see where this genre came from. And you know,
there were three games on Famicom
on disk system, I believe. Whatever platform it came out on, it was a trilogy that he did before Dragon Quest.
Oh
yeah,
cool. I knew there were like a two-part Famicom Tante club, but that's a different
series. That's like Nintendo is taking the idea on their own, but then there are remakes of those for Super Famicom that I want to play. That's a different story. So.
Yeah, we can get to our unfulfilled Super Famicom, Super NES wishes when we get to that anniversary.
Yeah, that's coming up.
All right. So I guess that is it for this episode. A lot of people talking about NES games. Not that we haven't before, but I think this particular facet of the system's history is interesting and relevant. So hope everyone enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week with a micro episode. In the meantime, you can find us at usgamer.net, at retronauts.com. You can find us on social media. And, of course, you can support podcasts like this where we're sitting in a room talking into an iPhone, which is very expensive, very complicated. We need your help making episodes like this through Patreon. So check out patreon.com/retronauts, and we'll send you free stuff after a few months. It's pretty cool. We're great guys. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.